My name is Marion Forbes. I am an alcoholic. And a very grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm extremely pleased to be here. I've been talking AA to great people ever since I arrived. I think sometime we ought to come to a conference a day after the conference is over so we can talk to the people who run the conference. Because the people who run the conference usually are so busy running conferences that I don't get a chance to catch up with them. And so next time I'm just going to come just to see you and you and you and you and visit. I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 24 years, last April the 4th. This is not anything spectacular to anybody else, but to me, it is a phenomena. Because I never really lived until I found AA and Alcoholics Anonymous people. I didn't know a thing in the world about living. I knew all about dying. I knew all about freezing and hurting and being turned off by my non-participation in living. I knew a lot of things that weren't true. I lived in a structured universe made up of people, opinions, concepts, and guilt. I lived behind barriers that were probably made by me from reacting to other people. I think that probably more than anything else, Alcoholics Anonymous has set me free of other people's concepts and opinions, which I used to think were the be-all of everything for me. I think the freedom to live and grow and be and find myself through the 12 steps of recovery of AA and how other people have done it as well as how I'm doing it has been one of the great freedoms of my life. I think probably the thing that is so valid in my life today is my sobriety and your sobriety, because we validate one another in how we feel about this program. My story is a story that I've come to believe I could have lived without booze just as easily as I did with booze. I used to think that I wouldn't have done any of those things if I hadn't been drunk, disorderly. I think I would have done every single solitary one of the things I did cold sober. I would have been crazy, but nevertheless, what's the difference? I think that when I got sober finally, and they said to take the first step, I am an alcoholic and my life has become unmanageable. I said, I'm an alcoholic and my life has become unmanageable. And I can prove it because look at all those things I did whilst drunk. And the truth of the matter is, since I've been sober, I've gotten honest enough to know that I would have probably done most of it if I could have allowed myself to do some of it without drinking. My life was unmanageable before I drank, my life was unmanageable during my drinking, and my life can become unmanageable now overnight or in a minute. If I begin to think that I'm the power that runs it. And so, to substantiate what the book says we're to do, I will talk about what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now. And I think with much emphasis on what I've liked now. Because today I looked in my mirror and I said, today I like you, Marion Forbes, and my mirror smiled back at me. And there wasn't a piece of tissue paper between us. Because I do like me today. Today I'm okay with God and I'm okay with you. And that's a very important thing for me, because if I'm uncomfortable, it's because somewhere I've put a piece of tissue paper between us. It could be that I want you to do something for me. And if that happens, I can just feel the thing that we all have after AA fly away. Or it could be that I've done something that is cute seeing my program. And I didn't want to do it, but somehow or other I did it, and that can produce a piece of tissue paper. By tissue paper, I mean the thinnest, most non-essential, inconsequential thing can produce a barrier between me and thee. And it can be like a piece of tissue paper. When I was drinking, I did not know about this. And I didn't know that I was uncomfortable much of the time because I was trying to get approval, get a feeling, get you to like me, get you to do something that would make us get along. I didn't know that I was living, always walking around with my begging bowl, asking you to approve of me. Therefore, there had to be a problem between me and people. There is a man who is a teacher in Baltimore, Maryland, that says that if he could get a hold of a family of alcoholics, he could save alcoholics from becoming acute alcoholics if he could instruct the family. And now, I don't believe this, but I believe that what his reason was pretty valid in my life, only in my life. He says that the dependence that an alcoholic has on a domineering parent can finally make the child of a domineering parent take their life and say, I can no longer do this. I guess I'll have to do it by myself. I guess I'll have to live my life by myself. And generally, it's before the child is able to make these decisions for themselves because they've never had a chance to grow in any way. Because of the domineering influence. And so many of us go out into the world vulnerable, unprepared, unknowing how to live because we have not been permitted to make our own decisions and permitted to walk in a way that would prepare us to live. And this, I think, is what happened to me. It's hot up here. Thank you. I remember when I was very tiny that I was just terribly in love with the whole world. My mother and father told me that from the time I was able to even be aware of what was going on around me, I was nuts about people. That there were times when people came to our house and I would have been glad to have gone off with them. That this child that was born was so full of love that it was all my nature was love. Love. And I vaguely remember this. I vaguely remember it because I remember when it changed. It changed when I was 5.5 years old and my brother was born. Up until the time I was 5.5 years old, my entire life was one of love. I loved hard and people loved me. I must have been extremely precious to my parents, and I must have been wanted, because no child could have had the beginnings that I had.
Well, maybe they can. Maybe they can.
But my recollection of this is very, very important to me. And then my brother was born, and he was ill. And he was very ill. And he almost didn't make it. And for a long time, there was no room for me. We had a housekeeper who had charge of me most of the time. And I remember that the doctors would come to the house a lot, and my mother was very grave. And she would say to me, "Marion, don't bother me. Get away. Don't bother me. Marion, get away now. Just go and get Elsie to take care of you." And then I recall vividly being thrown away and hating my brother. And feeling a deep, deep, deep sense of being thrown away. I've put all this together in the years of sobriety, and I've had some interesting things out of it, because when I've talked about it, people in the audiences a lot of times, and people I've sponsored have said, "I don't remember being thrown away, but I remember thinking that I had been thrown away." And this situation, I remember my father trying to bootleg affection to me, and my mother not permitting it. And I know that my mother didn't mean this now, but I didn't know it in those days. And I thought I had done something that deserved this punishment. And I was at this point in my life going to a Sunday school where they talked about the devil and hell, and you had to be good to get God. And the whole thing was a frightening experience for a little girl, especially somebody who had had all those marvelous early beginnings. I was the kind of a child who could go and climb up the top of a new building, a new house in our area, and fall off and, you know, get up and go home and never be hurt. But nobody cared. Apparently, nobody cared. And it was at that point in my life that I began to walk around trying to do things that would make people like me. When I went to school, it was difficult for me. When I went to grammar school, it was difficult for me. When I went to into high school, it was difficult for me. When I was 12 years old, my parents changed location, and we moved from Cleveland, Ohio to Portland, Oregon. And it was difficult for me. I did not know how to move. I did not know how to make new friends, and did not know how to be who apparently almost I thought everybody else in the world knew, how to be who they were. When something happens in one's life that they react to a situation and they learn something, they become there's a taught syndrome in here somewhere. When that happens, I think that our mind begins to feed us behavioral patterns, and I think we get computerized. And I did. I think that as long as we can make something work for us, we're going to make it work. And when it doesn't work, we're going to keep on trying in another situation. And so I look back from where I was when I finally got sober, and the days in my life had kept changing, but I hadn't. I was treating every new situation as though it was the old situation. I was updating my behavior and bringing my behavior into a new situation and acting it up, just as I had early on. When I was 17 years old, my mother and father divorced. My brother was left in school in the West, and I was brought to New York in the East with my mother to my mother's family. And that was a switch, because always it had been my brother who had done it, and it was I this time. And I didn't want to, and my brother didn't want to. But that was the way it was. And at that time, my father went into bankruptcy and lost every dime he had and every dime the rest of us had. And we had no money, and we had no family, and the family was split. And I had, all my life, had disagreed with people who drank. I did not like drinking. When I saw it in our home, I didn't like it, though it was modest. I didn't like it. I didn't want drinking. I didn't want drinking people around me. And I believe that the first thing I did when I got to the East, I found out that everybody drank, the first thing I did was to say to people, I don't drink and I don't want to. And eventually what happened was that I decided that the only way that I was going to live with people was to try and do what they did so I would not be so unusual. People would say to me, why don't you drink? And I'd say, I just don't care for it. And they'd say, but we all drink. And I'd think, they're going to throw me away too. And so in the midst of my 17th and 18th year, I began to drink as little as I could to get them off my back so that they wouldn't disapprove of me. And I think that the first time that we sell ourselves down the river, the first time we betray ourselves in life, we set up a pattern. Giving in a little may keep them from not approving of me, and then I began to give in a little more, and a little more, and a little more. What was right for me, always, I knew. When I got on this program and people said, you'll find a conscious contact with God, I was so overjoyed I could hardly stand it, because I thought if I had a conscious contact with God, I would be able to implement the things I always knew that I should do about me. And I think that that's one of the most tremendous guarantees that AA gives us, that we will implement what our insides have always known about us. We can begin to be faithful to our gut in such a way that we'll never have to do anything just to get along with anybody again. It was the most important, valid thing in my life when I realized that I always had guidance. I'd always had guidance, but they had been so important to me. And what they thought of me, whoever the theys were, that I could not be true to what my gut said. So this is a sad beginning to a life. On one hand, the domination of my mother had always been terribly valuable to me, and my need for her had been so important. And yet, truthfully, I was so angry, inside me so angry, that I had not gotten any kind of a strong leadership strength beginnings in my life, that I knew that I was going to be angry at that for the rest of my life. And yet I couldn't tell anybody that I was angry. I was angry. And in the 24 years I've been sober, I have talked to Alcoholics Anonymous members who have said, I was never angry. Why would I have been angry? I had a perfect life. Only to find out later that anger was a very, very sick, sick part of their lives. Maybe the major defect of character in my life has been unresolved discontent based on anger, on the anger that I felt when I got out in the world, that I was not ready to live and didn't know how to live, and was therefore prey to other people's opinion, other people's thoughts. I don't know that this is something that people will even want to hear, but I would be less than honest with you if I did not think that one of the basic problems of alcoholism is anger. Is a problem that we've had, that we have not gotten a fair shake. That people have never really known who we were. That if things had been different, we would have been able to deal with them. If we had known more, we could have done better. And the first thing I think people have to do when they get sober is to say, okay. All right, I've been angry. And be able to make a list of the people who have who have put this anger in our life so that we can get to a place where we'll let go of it. If, as long as I'm going to update anger, I'm going to have to be judgmental, find fault with, demand, and end up always ruining beautifully sweet relationships. And Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe the most important thing is, how do I feel about you? It doesn't really make much difference how you feel about me, but it's terribly important how I feel about you. Because if I'm not comfortable in how I feel about you, I'm going to get a resentment. And I'm going to get self-pity. And my anger is going to be churned up again. And I'm going to do something at you. Once upon a time, I drank at you. I suppose a lot of people take pills at you. That's not my bad. But there's a lot of chemicals around today, and people take chemicals at. I know what it is to eat at, and I know an awful lot of people who use sex at. But my point is that it's because of how I feel about you. In the years that I've been sober, systematically, I've had to go back and back and back with me to keep any kind of feeling that you could have any power over me whatsoever. And the blessing of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. And that's where I have to live. Because if I'm going to walk around my life giving power to others, they have then the power to kill me, to hurt me, to make me feel resentful, to make me feel self-pity. I know better. I know better. If I'm going to have problems with people, it's because I'm setting myself up to have you throw me away again, or to have you hurt me. Is some sort of self-seducing mechanism that I'm putting out, so I'm going to put myself in a position to be killed. See, nobody can kill me, but they can make me wound myself if I give them the power. So let's think about it. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could relieve me of my alcoholism or my other problems. And C, that God couldn't, would if he were sought. Never says anything about you being able to do one thing for me or to me. But if I love you and I feel good about you, it doesn't make any difference what you think about me, because I can't help but go through life giving to you. And then I feel good about me. I'm convinced that I married the first time to get away from my mother. Mostly, I think I'm married the first time to get away from what I call the white glove syndrome. Women, ladies in my era were born and raised by mothers who said, you do this and you do that, and Aunt Florence is coming and you be here at 3 o'clock. And I say, but Aunt Florence has mustaches growing out of here, and she kisses me and she has bad breath. And my mother says, what difference does that make? She's got money and she's going to leave you something. And I say, well, why doesn't Robert have to do it this time? And she says, because boys don't have to do those things. And what does that do to me? Anger. Churn up anger. White glove syndrome. So I'm convinced that I finally got married the first time to get away from my mother and the white glove syndrome. And I married a man who had a mother and nobody set me up for that. I set myself up for that. When you take your inventory, have the courage to say, I set myself up for everything that happened. Johnny's and my sponsor says, if there be fault, it is mine. If you set yourself up, that's what you do. The habit patterns are so powerful by now, and I'm trying to get out of the mess I'm in and I write a script in my head. And the script says, I'll marry Jack, and he's got all that money and property and prestige, and his family love me, and they're so good to me, and then my mother will stop running my life. And I get married to Jack, and he starts to run my life. Boom. And his mother says, I wouldn't do that if I were you, dear. And before I know it, I'm surrounded with a bigger bunch of that stuff than I have just outgrown, I thought. And my mother comes up to see us, and I'm sitting there in my beautiful house, surrounded by this beautiful silver and these glorious antiques, and this lovely crystal, and I've got on beautiful clothes, and I've got on exactly what everybody picked for me, including the pearls and the color sweater I'm wearing. And my mother says, oh, you've got it made, or whatever her words were in those years. And I look at her and I think, how can she be so damn stupid? I am full of pain. I hate it. What am I doing in it? And when I finally, one day in great despair, went in to see her and said to her, I can't live it anymore. She said, I don't know what's the matter with you. You've never been happy in your whole life. You've got everything in the world to make you happy. And I think maybe she's right. I've got to be crazy. 5 years of the marriage, and one day I said to him, I've got to take my daughter, who was then, is still in her first year, and we've got to go. We can't live with you anymore. And he said, oh, dear, go out to the West Coast and see your father. You've just been a little edgy since the baby was born. And I think, isn't he nice? And I get on the train and go out to the West Coast, and while he's gone, he brought up witnesses that I was an unfit mother and brought suit against me for a divorce and to keep the custody of my child. And once again, people are running my life, only now it's beginning to hurt. And I don't know a thing about how to protect myself. I know nothing at all about how to protect myself. I have no clue. All I know is that I'm in terrible, terrible trouble. And I was. Because he did get my child. But all my family said, he's got to be right because, you know, Marion, she's such a terrible liar. She never has been happy in that thing. So obviously, Jack is right and Marion's wrong. I went to Florida to get a divorce, and everybody said, wasn't he wonderful to me because he gave me enough money to get a divorce. And he's kept my child, my house, my furniture, what I had when we were married. And I am left out there. Pretty soon I get back up, and I go out to the country to see my child, and people who've been my close friends walk across the street not to speak to me. And I'm 25 years old. Booze has never been a problem yet. I've gotten stoned out of my skull but I don't have an alcoholic problem, I don't think. After I'd been sober, I came to believe that probably from the very first drink I'd had an alcoholic problem because I used alcohol or I used alcohol for. I used alcohol for the wrong reasons, and I think we do. Those of us who are alcoholics were born 5 feet off the ground, and for us to put anything chemical in us is to take off, like my husband says, a jet-ass bird. And it's the truth. It's the truth. What happened? Why was this more important to me than to the average person? Because the average person would have said, you've got to be crazy. I've got you where dead to rights. You're a drunk. The things I know about you, I can prove. What's the matter with you? Not me. I panicked, I ran, and I never stopped running until I'd made everything much, much too terrible for me. But from the time I was 25 years old until I got sober in AA when I was 39 years old, I was a second-class woman, in my opinion. And I never expected ever again to have anything happen that was valid or good. And it really was not until I found Alcoholics Anonymous that I stopped running. I didn't stop running until I found Alcoholics Anonymous and realized that the things I had been doing were the things that I had started put in motion from the time I was little. The people who taught me were people who knew a great deal about the alcoholic. And the most important person in my life was Chuck C. because he knew who I was from the beginning. I think that if anybody had known who I was at any time in my drinking life and had stopped in my tracks and said, I understand, you are not who you are acting out. You are somebody entirely different than this thing, this pattern that you're acting out. I might have been able to hear them, but I don't know. After I was 29 years old, I couldn't have heard anybody, because that was the first time that I tried to kill myself from alcoholism. And for the next 10 years, my life was pure alcoholic living. I married twice, both times repeat pattern. Lovely. Money, property, prestige, brilliance. I always married very brilliant men who could always write patterns that were better than mine. My last husband, while I was drinking, my third husband, was an unbelievably wonderful man who had been in the service, decorated, written up, one of the most tremendous people I've ever known in my whole life. But he was an alcoholic. And when he got angry, he started fighting the Japs, and I was always the whole regiment. We had an enormous house. We raised racehorses. It was cool. Listen, let's face it. If I could have lived there, it would have been fine, but I almost died there too many times. He had a thing about fireplaces. We had fireplaces in every room of our house, all the bedrooms, all the living room, study, dining room. And wherever he was stoned, he put me in the fireplace and tried to burn me up. And you've got to know that that's something else, too. What was happening to me all this time? I'm still walking around with the white glove syndrome. On the outside, you wouldn't believe what I was living in. You would not have known the terror, the fear, the agony. I did not get drunk in bars. I did not get drunk in nightclubs. I didn't even get drunk at people's houses. I waited till I got home and everybody was in bed, and then I'd go down the stairs and get the glass, and up the stairs and go to bed, and down the stairs to get the glass, and up the stairs to get... I never was going to drink another drink. I never bought a bottle because I was going to get smashed. I just bought a bottle to have around. I got to be a closet drinker. I got to be a clothes drinker. I was a very uneasy woman, because all I'd been trained for was to be a lady, and what my behavior was not that of a lady. And it was damn tough. And I look back on it now and think, I suppose I would have gone on forever if it had not been that one night, one April 1st, 1950, April Fool's Day, a woman called me from downstairs in my apartment. I now was divorced and living in California, and a woman called me and she said, I'd like to come up and speak to you. And I said, do I know you? And she said, no, but I know you. And I don't know yet why I said okay, because that was a day that I'd been so depressed and so hurt, and I'd been thinking about suicide again, and I was agonized because not one member of my family or any of my friends were speaking to me. I had no friends left. And she came up, I suppose it was curiosity, why somebody would want to talk to me. And she talked to me. She came to the door and she said, I've come to ask you to leave him alone. And I said, who are we talking about? Because as far as I was concerned, there was no him in my life. And she said, him. And she told me who she was talking about. She said, you see, I've kept him for many years. I'm responsible for his debts. I send him to school. He wants to be an actor, and I'm prepared to live with this. But every once in a while comes somebody along who has more money and who is more beautiful than I, and that's you. And I looked at her and I said, I don't really know what you're saying, because and then I realized, of course I know what she's saying. Of course I know what she's saying. This man had been giving me a big whirl. And I realized, sick in my inside, that probably because I had some money and because I still looked pretty good, he might have decided I'd be very good to replace her with, and he could go on his whatever it was he was doing. And my heart went down into my gut, and I suddenly turned on myself in a way I had never before, because I could see. It didn't have anything to do with how beautiful I thought I might still be. I was 39 years old, and I had gotten into something so unsavory, so wretched, so filthy. And I don't know how I got her out, but I remember saying to her, "Dear lady, I didn't know, and you have nothing to fear from me." And she thanked me, and she left. And I walked to the mirror in my bathroom, and I opened the medicine cabinet, and I took out 38 green and a half Nembutals I'd been saving, and I said to the mirror, "You've blown it this time. You've gone too far." And my old thing of trying to explain myself to me wouldn't work. I had gone too far. I had gone further than I was ever going to be able to stand myself. And I went in and sat down with those 38 pills, and I thought to myself, I am no longer responsible about what's going to happen to me. I no longer have any right to think that I am going to be able to keep the inevitable from happening. Whatever is going to happen next is going to be worse, and I'm just going to keep going down, 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 down. And I don't know quite how I knew that in my own heart I was finished with me, but I knew it. And I took the pills. That was Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock. I wasn't even very high. I don't think I'd been drunk for days. Because I hadn't been able to get drunk and I hadn't been able to get sober. I was just living in that place that we all find eventually, where the unresolved discontent and the tragedy of our lives is just all we know about. And I was alert and aware most of the time to the vegetable that I had become. I don't even think I was resentful. I don't think I've ever blamed anybody for throwing me away. I just think I thought it was inevitable because I wasn't worthy. And I took the pills. The next night at 10 o'clock, or 9:30, somewhere around there, I came to, and when I came to, I realized that whatever had been the reason that I thought I had to die was no longer there. I was absolutely aware that I not only didn't need to die, but that I never needed to drink again. I was alive to what was the possibility if I would get up out of that bed and walk away from my past. Nothing had changed. I still had the same past. I still had no thought that I would ever see my daughter again. I certainly didn't know that I would ever have my family, any of my family, again. I had the same problems. I had intruded in people's lives and knew it. I didn't expect anybody to change anything, but I knew that something had happened to me, and I had changed. And the next day, I went to my doctors and told him what had happened. And he said, "You must go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "Oh, no, I tried that. 1946, I tried that. You wouldn't believe those people. They're dreadful," I said. Yeah. And he said, "Oh, yes." He said, "That's what all people say who go to AA and can't make it." He said, "The people who are superior to Alcoholics Anonymous generally are on their last swing around." And I thought, ooh, you know, he's saying to me I'm superior, and I guess even in my sickness I thought I was. He said, where did you go to AA? And I told him. I told him that I had gone to a sanitarium and I'd loved the drunks in the sanitarium, but I didn't like the AAs. And he said, why not? And I said, well, I went to an all-men's meeting. And the women stayed outside, and the men went in, and those women would look at me like this as I went in with their husbands. And what's the difference? They've been doing that every time I went to the kitchen with their husbands for years. And I remember he looked at me and he said, I think you're ready for a better life. And if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, they will teach you to understand why those women looked at you like that. And though I didn't like it, I knew he was right. I knew he was right. So I said, well, let me think about it, and I'll make a decision when I can think about it, and in my right mind. And I, little did I know that I wouldn't have my right mind for some months. Because when you come to AA and you think all you have to do is quit drinking and you'll be well, boy, you've got some changes to be made. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous the next night. The people who came for me were the worst people in the world to send for me. They'd never heard of a white glove syndrome. And it didn't make any difference. Because suddenly I wanted to be sober more than I wanted my next breath. And it was as simple as that. And though I've had some strange things happen in my need to grow up in this program, and I've done a lot of fighting with myself about things, from that night until this time, I've never wanted another drink. It's never occurred to me that a drink could change anything. Alcohol was totally and completely removed. And I know it's because I had surrendered. And more than that, I think it's because I repudiated myself after that woman left that day. I think I repudiated. I think I said, I will never live with the self I have made of me. Because I think even when I took the pills that day, I knew that I was not trying to kill off myself, but what I had made of me out here in my living experience. I don't think any of us ever really want to kill ourselves. I think we want to wipe away the less than the best image that we're putting out in the world. I hadn't been sober very long when one day it came to me that all I had ever wanted in my whole life was to have my insides and my outsides match. All I had ever wanted in my whole life was not to have this out here and this in here. And I'd always gotten this wrong. I thought if you would do what you were supposed to do, then I'd be all right in here. And I hadn't been sober. I really don't think I've been sober more than a little bit. When one night after I went home from a meeting, I was doing my thing of staring out, looking at the gorgeous lights of Los Angeles, and realizing that there was no longer a them and a me. And it came to me. That's why. Now I'm living from my inside out. And the outside of me is being blessed by the inside. And by now I've heard our sponsor. I met him at my first meeting. And I heard him say, it comes this way. God operates through us and out. And I kept thinking, of course, it's got to be. And I think the first time I ever heard him talk, he said, God in whom I live and move and have my being. And I thought, of course. And all that stuff that I had up there with all those bookkeepers keeping track of me and God off in that department and hell off in that department, just all dissolved. Just, and there I realized, if I live and move and have my being in God, if I live, it's no longer this. this. It isn't this that lives. It's all of me. It's my consciousness. It's my awareness. It's who I am who lives. And then, of course, I couldn't live separate and apart, could I? There could not be a selfhood out there separate and apart from God if I lived and moved. Whatever I did, wherever I went, on a plane, talk at a meeting, whatever, if I moved, then God must be omnipresent, all present, and I must move in and out. And the only way I could get out of it was to have self-will. And the opposite of willingness is self-will. The opposite of self-will is willingness. And if I was willing to live and move and have my being, all of me in this, all I had to do was claim it. And one night I'm sitting in a meeting and they're reading chapter 5, and it's this night what I heard them say was, we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And I thought, that's it. I put it in my program. So before I got out of bed every morning, I had about 4 hours of things that I put in my program, because everything I heard applied to me. All my life I'd walked around applying everything to everybody else. And finally I was applying to me. And my unresolved discontent went out the window, because there's not room for God and live and move and have my being and unresolved discontent. It disappeared. I had 11 of the most marvelous years anybody ever had. I married, finally, on August the 13th, 3 days ago, I've been married 22 years. Believe it, it's a miracle. Maybe not for you, for me. After I've been married to Tony a while, he started sending me back and forth to see what I could do about my daughter, and nothing. The Al-Anons, now I have to tell you about the Al-Anons. The Al-Anons came into my life. The women were in my life before Al-Anon, but not in the same way. Because when the Al-Anon came along, some of you really got to be dolls. And the Al-Anons began to take an active part in my life. Elsa Chamberlain, I guess, was the first one. I always adored her. She was just something else. And she began to say things to me like, I don't understand why the women don't think that they have a disease of alcoholism, but they're willing that the men have the disease of alcoholism. And I'd say, what? She said, honey, you still want approval awful bad, and I think it's because you haven't accepted the disease concept for yourself. She said, why would you think that I would think that my husband was a victim of a disease called alcoholism, but you were a bum? And I thought, that's right. She's telling the truth. I always thought it was okay for you men, white glove syndrome again. You know, that's the way I was raised. You men could be a drunk, but I couldn't because I was a lady. And she helped me get through that. And I could accept the fact that we, you know, alcoholism is an illness. Therefore, I have an illness. Then the Al-Anons began to help me with my child problem. And I went to... Well, every time I'd go to New York, something would happen and I wouldn't get to see Jerry. Finally, when I was 4.5 years sober, my daughter's father called one day and asked me to come and get her. And I was not even afraid, but it was interesting. It was the time, finally, that I knew that I could say what I knew and state my case. And I said to him, all my life I've wanted to come and get Jerry, but I have to tell you now, I'll do it, but not on your terms. If you will stay the hell out of it, I'll come and get Jerry. But if you're going to begin to manipulate and maneuver and play your dirty tricks, no way. And he said, come and get Jerry, she's in terrible trouble. And I said, is she an alcoholic? And he said, what difference does that make? And I said, well, I'll be there. So I went. And I went, And this is the way I went. Holding my hand in God's because I knew I couldn't do this. I never had been able to, and I didn't expect to be able to. And I had a hold of God's hand so hard. And I went to New York and got on the train and went up to Connecticut. And I called up and told Jerry I was there. And I went down and talked to her, the psychologist she was going to, and asked the psychologist if I could take her. And she said, don't wait a day. Your daughter's father sent for you to drive her home because she's mixed up in something that's quite bad for her. And take her now. Don't wait a day. So I met her, and I said, let's go to California. And she said, oh, I couldn't leave old What's-His-Face, whose name escapes me. And I said, bring him along. It's fine. Bring him along, too. And I'm pleased to be able to tell you that she came. And old What's-His-Face didn't stay. And I watched my daughter, age 20, be a drunk for 4 months and make fun of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I watched her with that same pain I'd always had. And I watched her with an outside and an inside that didn't match. And I watched it with pain because my husband and I both were alcoholics. Her father and I were both alcoholics, and I knew that we had done something between us that only her own surrender was ever going to help her face. We couldn't make her surrender for her. And I know that better today than I've ever known it. 4 months after she came to live with us, she went to an AA meeting with me in Burbank, and I bought her last drink that night. She's never had a drink since. And she's been sober 19 years. She has not had a drink for 19 years. She has 3 daughters. She married, lived with an alcoholic, a wonderful member of AA, 15 years, and they got a divorce. And they're both a lot happier. But my daughter had to learn that she couldn't live my program, she couldn't live her husband's program, she couldn't live my husband's program, she couldn't live Dottie's program or Johnny's program or Chuck Chamberlain's program. She had to learn to live her program. And that's what she's been doing these last years, and she really is doing fine. But what did it do? There I was. I've married. My husband's at the University of California. He's getting a doctorate, and then he became a teacher. My daughter's there, and she's in AA, and she was at the university at that point. And one day I woke up to myself, and I've been sober 5.5 years, and I said, what do I do now? Because everything I had come to AA to accomplish had happened. I had gotten to be a good wife, as good as I can be. I'd gotten to be a good mother. Everything was fixed. But I still had an empty. There was still something in me that was empty. And that's when I started living the AA program. And until I was 11 years sober, my program was one of daily living. And I can tell you, I lived in heaven. Every moment. When I was 12 and 13, things began to bother me. I began to have an uncomfortable. I didn't fit in my husband's university groups, and I began to have an uncomfortable. The newest newcomer could have seen it. And then we moved to the Middle West. And my husband got a job as chairman of the history department in a university in Michigan, and I sat in Marquette, Michigan with no Alcoholics Anonymous, no people, no home, home inside myself. Lovely, elegant home on the water, but what's that? I had money, property, and prestige all my life, and it hadn't fixed anything. And here I was, looking out the window, wishing that I was back in California where I had a home. Because I found out that if I was not active and participating in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time, I was not living as well as I wanted to live. And that began a going back and forth from California to Marquette, and to California and Marquette. And people began to look at me with hurt eyes. And I began to feel guilty. And then my babies used to look at me and say, "You don't seem the same." And I'd say to them, "Dearie, maybe I'm not. I'm going through a hard time. Why don't you go and talk to Chuck? Or why don't you go and..." It was a very difficult period, not only for me, but for everybody around me. And for about 3.5 years, I lived in what I would call a real dry drunk. I didn't know it. I didn't know what a dry drunk was. I didn't understand what a dry drunk was. I didn't understand that I picked up my will again. I didn't understand that I had not the courage to say, "I cannot live where there's not Alcoholics Anonymous." And about 3.5 years, one day I woke up and I called for help. And I went down to see my sponsor and I said, "All this time, haven't you known that I was crazy?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "All this time, why didn't you tell me?" He said, "I did. Every time I saw you, I told you." And I said, "What'd you say?" And he said, "I kept saying, what difference does it make what gets you drunk?" And that's the truth. That's what he said it from a million podiums. And I didn't realize. You cannot have a dry drunk if you are paying attention to putting your program first. You can't have a dry drunk if you absolutely, positively know gratitude in every fiber of your being. You can't have a dry drunk unless you pick up the bondage of self again. And in page 63 of our A book, it says, "Remove me from the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Clear away my difficulties that I may bear witness." The bondage of self. And I went around the world. That was one of my escapes. I went around the world. I thought, if I get away and learn to meditate, and so I went to India and I learned to meditate with the Indians. During that 3.5 years, I did everything that any nut would do, but when I came through it all, I realized that what I had to do was something I think very few people know they have to do. I started with the first half of step one. And I said, at the age of almost 17 years of sobriety, I said, "I am an alcoholic. And my life is totally and completely unmanageable by me ever. And the only way that it can be managed is if I am totally and completely willing to know that only a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity and keep me sane." And I made a new decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And all of a sudden, I understood a lot more than I'd ever understood, because I had known the words and I had known it in my heart and I had lived in heaven. But I had not known that there are certain things I have to make decisions about myself. We cannot yoke ourselves into a situation that is before Alcoholics Anonymous ever. And I had said it and said it and said it that my sobriety had to come first. But I had never, I guess, heard myself say it. Because by the time I had seen the error of my ways, I did a new fourth, a new fifth, a new sixth, a new seventh, a new eighth, a new ninth, and I stayed on 10, 11, and 12, and went right back and started one again, and kept it up until I had totally and completely cleaned my house again. And this day is the way I do this. Every morning of my life, when I get up, I put my life and my will on God. And I make sure that any will of mine, I trim the excess so that there is no chance of it not matching that day. And if I begin to pick up any kind of thing that would lead me to any kind of discomfort, if there's anything between me and you, I stop right where I am and realize this is a disease of the mind rather than the body. And on page 23, it says, therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. So anything that happens to me when I am sober and free from chemicals that is not my wife and my will on God has to be some self-seducing mechanism in my mind that says, this time it's going to be different. Or I've been sober so long, what's the difference? Or somewhere I begin to cutesy. Or maybe, just maybe, I begin to want something. And if I want something, I can feel the Spirit leave me. It's just as simple as that. I was at my sponsor's a few weeks ago and spent 4 hours there. And I think maybe one of the reasons why I finally have grown to a place where I'm more comfortable than I've ever been, ever, is because that man has shown me a path to live. I think that his awareness has been a candle for many of us, lit bright and shining. Maybe the fact that he was never at any time in 24 years not available to me. Maybe that I've never called, that he hasn't said to me or she hasn't said to me, come on down, let's talk it over. This is the only way I know that Alcoholics Anonymous could work for me. I cannot fault the man I call sponsor. And to be less than my best ability would not be proper for me. You know, if we get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's because we have surrendered what booze has done to us, what we think is booze done to us. We have given up, and we're awestruck by the miracle of what's happening in this program. If we, after a while, begin to think that we're not awestruck, and it's not the miracle any longer, and we get used to being sober, maybe we get to be somebody again. Maybe we get big shot a little. Maybe we get to be somebody. Maybe we get back that thing of running things again, and we're maneuvering things again, and having our own way again, and making plans again, instead of living with what comes next. I'm sure this is what happened to me. I got to be somebody. And thank God that the lesson I lived was the kind I lived that taught me I never wanted to be somebody. That's what my problem was all those years. I didn't want to be somebody. All I've ever wanted was to love like I loved when I was a child. Totally, completely, asking for nothing back, just to love. And not know that there were people out there who didn't love. That's what I mean. What you do with your life is your business. But what I do with my life has to be subject to God. I love. Today I love. Today I love. And I'm aware of why I love. I love because I don't want you to do anything for me. I love because I don't expect anything of you. I love because I found that the God that I've come to know in Alcoholics Anonymous needs me for a channel, just like he needs you for a channel. And as long as we are both being channels, there's nothing else to life except watching people get well and watching ourselves getting well along too. I'm afraid I've overtalked my time. I've got about 5,000 more things I want to say. But the most important thing I want to say is thank you for asking me and thank you for listening.